for coming. I have a little bit of how... my name's Victoria Perman. I'm lucky enough to be the one chatting with Natasha tonight. I have a little bit of housekeeping. So what I thought we'd do is, firstly, welcome Natasha Lester.
Thank you. Excuse me while I just...
She's busy pouring water.
Being the mum.
Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge that we meet on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people here tonight. I would like to acknowledge elders past, present and emerging, and also to point out that our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people were the original storytellers of this nation, with stories that go back 60,000 years. And if you don't know the story of the Seven Sisters, it's incredible. And I encourage you to look it up.
I'm totally distracted by that disco ball up there. Can anyone else see that? It's amazing. Very appropriate. It's just there, yeah.
It's very 70s, and we're going to get to that
right later. Now I'll concentrate.
Natasha is a New York Times and internationally best-selling author, or as you are known in some parts of the world, Natasha Lesterova.
I know, it's my spy name.
Her books have been number one in Norway. Several have hit the USA Today bestseller list as well. She's translated into 21 languages, and her last six books have all made the Australian bestseller lists. I think that deserves a round of applause, don't you?
Thank you.
This is the second last event on Natasha's whirlwind Australian tour, so we're very lucky that... Is this your first time in Adelaide?
It is my first time in Adelaide, and for at least the last 3 years, every time I put up a tour, it's all the people from Adelaide who say, "Are you coming?" And I have to say, "No, I'm sorry." And this year I was able to go, "Yes, I am." So I'm slightly delirious because it is the second last event, but that will just make it even more fun, right?
It's going to be crazy. We're going to go off, aren't we? It's going to be wild. She's flying home tomorrow morning at 20 past six.
10 past six.
10 past six.
The driver's coming at 4:45, so yeah. I'm really looking forward to that.
But these are the burdens authors have to bear, right? I have so many questions for you, and I'm sure the audience will too. So please put your hands together again for Natasha Lester. I think we're going to go straight into a reading. We're talking just before, and this book's about three generations of women, but we're going to start at the very beginning, and Natasha's going to read the prologue. So for those of you who haven't read the book, you'll get an idea of the mystery at the heart of this story.
Okay, let's do it. Yes, so this is the prologue, so no spoilers here, and it's just a couple of pages long. Palace of Versailles, France, 28th of November, 1973. In the same way that the Electric Circus nightclub in Manhattan is all about sensual overwhelm, so too is the Hall of Mirrors at the Palace of Versailles, Hawke thinks, as he strides into the gallery beside four other men. The club's excess comes from bands like Velvet Underground playing so loudly the music feels like a secondary heartbeat. From the fire eaters swallowing flames like candy, and from the light show flashing over canvas-draped walls that make you believe the room is leaning inwards and, a minute later, that you're the one who's on a slant. But the extravagance here is of a different order, manifested in so many mirrors there's nowhere to hide. Hawke can see himself caught from all angles and reflected 1,000 times beneath cathedral-like painted ceilings, the kind that make you feel guilty even when you've done nothing wrong. For one disquieting second, Hawke wonders if this is what it will come down to, a belief that this kind of history makes French couture supreme versus six American designers trying to show that a dress meant to writhe to the Rolling Stones is what fashion is now. He wants Astrid to saunter in and prove that very fact. But where is she? He glances over at Bill Blass, dressed as always in tweed and tobacco. Beside him is Oscar de la Renta in dignified black, Stephen Burrows in naivete, and Halston in self-admiration. Hawke knows better than to ask any of them if they've seen Astrid. "Allons-y," their French chaperone calls disdainfully, as if he'd rather be accompanying Yves Saint Laurent and the rest of the French team, who everyone believes will whip the Americans so completely that not just their clothes, but their skins will be left in ribbons. To tell the truth, some days Hawke thinks that too. As if to bolster Hawke's fears, Hubert de Givenchy, a man Hawke couldn't have named 6 years ago, but who is now chatted to several times, enters. He's elegant in suit and tie, so intrinsically the French couturier, that even the lines on his face look to have been pleated with a seamstress's precision. Hawke almost tugs at the sleeves of his favourite grey sweater, but he remembers that he's 28 years old and has earned the right to be there, which maybe only proves how thin on the ground designers are in America. He looks around again for Astrid before the Hall of Mirrors exposes his agitation. Against all odds, the Americans have to win tonight. Otherwise, Hawke and Astrid will never be together, and that's not a thought he wants to even contemplate, let alone have reflected to the whole goddamn room. Get it together. He rubs his hand over the stubble on his jaw and reminds himself that Hawke Jones is the man life called the premier fashion designer in all America. Bonjour. Givenchy greets them with a handshake, always a gentleman. Good luck for this evening. Halston, who'd as soon be called a gentleman as Hawke would be called conservative, mutters, smug asshole, and Hawke sees relief across Blass's and De La Renta's faces that Halston's expletive wasn't, for once, completely offensive. And then the mirrors show Hawke some more sober reality. A team of American designers, who are really a set of squabbling egos, thrown together for a show that everyone from Princess Grace of Monaco to the Duchess of Windsor, as well as every newspaper and magazine across America and Europe is attending. There they are at the Palace of Versailles, about to do battle for their country's honour to be crowned fashion capital of the world, and the five of them are barely on speaking terms, and it's seen as a win when Halston doesn't outright tell someone to fuck off. And the whole of Hawke's happiness is riding on this. The mirrors shift again. Now they reflect not just his terrified face, but a bundle on the floor near one of the statues. The bundle becomes, with a sudden, sharp twist of his heart, the delectable white column dress he'd seen Astrid making yesterday, a dress he'd believed would make everyone applaud her and acclaim her, at last, with the recognition she deserves. Why the hell is the centrepiece of Astrid's collection lying sprawled on the floor of the Hall of Mirrors? Hawke's feet move him forward. He's halfway across the vast, glittering hall before anyone else notices the bundle. He's three quarters of the way across when he sees that a crimson sash of savage red now stains the silk. His feet halt. His head turns away. But all around him, the mirrors double, triple, and quadruple the violence of that dress, and he swears now, loudly, the sound reverberating as if it might shatter every damn mirror before his fist does. Because if the red staining Astrid's gown is blood, then he knows that means Astrid is dead or gone, and so too is he. So now you have to read it, right?
So that prologue really gets to that question of what happened to Astrid Brickard.
It won't be revealing tonight.
No spoilers. But I want to take you back to, as I mentioned, the three generations of women. And you start, well, you cover those three women. Who is the first Brickard that we meet in the book?
So the first Brickard who we meet is a woman named Mitza Brickard, who, if you've read one of my previous books, The Three Lives of Alexandre, you will have met Mitza in that book. Mitza has gone down in history as Christian Dior's muse, but there's a lot more to Mitza Brickard than meets the eye. So her story in the book traverses from 1917, when she was a 17-year-old, right through to 1947, when she begins to work with Christian Dior for the first time.
And you tackle that in the book, that who she was might not be the person presented in the history books.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Every time I've read a non-fiction book about Christian Dior, so a non-fiction book being fact or truth, there's always a part about Mitza in one of those books. And all of those books, all of those articles agree that Mitza Brickard was apparently a woman who found underwear optional, loved a fur coat with nothing underneath, wore jewellery from head to toe, jewellery furnished by her many, many, many lovers, that she was probably a demi-horizontale, which is a fancy French way of saying lady of the night, and that all she did in her life was live at the Ritz, get up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, swan into Dior, inspire him to make a gown, and then head off to her next rendezvous with her lovers.
Sounds perfect to me.
Exactly. So I believed this story. I thought, okay, that's what she was, because that's what every single book said that she was. And it wasn't until I began to do quite a lot of digging into Mitzah's life that I found a very different story. I spent so much time in archives researching Mitzah, and it was the first time in my life that I felt like I was doing new research and finding a story that had not really been written anywhere before. I guess the first thing that really made me think Mitzah was somewhat different to how she'd been presented was I found a shipping record that showed that Mitzah had travelled from Paris to New York in 1924, and she was 24 years old, and on the shipping record it tells you the place she's going to be spending most of her time when she's in New York, and the place was the Harry Angelo Company, and I didn't know what that was, so I went and did a bit of research and I had a look. And back in the 1920s, there were no French couturiers operating out of New York. To buy French designs as an American, the Paris designers would send their most trusted representative over to New York with all of their designs. This person would show the designs to the two big garment manufacturers in New York at the time, one of whom was Harry Angelo. And then Harry would purchase the models he most liked and he would make those up for his American customers. So the only reason Mitzah could have been travelling as a 24-year-old woman to see Harry Angelo was because she was the trusted representative of some designer showing these designs, and she was seen so highly by whichever designer that was that they felt that she would be able to convince Harry to purchase a number of designs from her. I thought, well, that's very different to being a muse, to be able to, at 24 years old, when most women in 1924, at 24 years old, haven't even left the village they were born in, let alone travelled across the seas to another country and been trusted with this kind of responsibility. So that made me dig so much more. And I found so many amazing articles about Mitzah that have been somehow buried. One of them was her obituary, which was written, published in Harper's and Queen in 1977. And in that obituary, it said that Mitzah Brocard was a greater designer than Coco Chanel. Now, that's a pretty big call. You think of one Paris couturier, and Chanel is one of the names that springs to mind. And the final thing that sealed the deal for me was a 1950 article published in the Sydney Morning Herald. And I love that there's an Australian connection for this. And it talks in that article about the person on the Dior staff who is second only in importance to the great man himself, and that this person is Christian Dior's first assistant designer, and that she's instrumental in the design of every single Christian Dior model, and that woman was Mitzah Brocard. And I thought, wow, how does a person go from Christian Dior's first assistant designer, the most important person on the staff besides Christian, the woman who should have had her name on the label on the back of every single gown alongside Dior's, how does she become the Nicholas whore who was like seducing all of these men? And that was what really made me want to write this book and kind of show people who Mitzah really was and put her story down correctly for the first time.
Why has she been forgotten?
Yeah, I guess that when it comes to tantalising anecdotes, the woman in the fur coat with no underwear on sounds so much more exciting than Christian Dior's first assistant designer, doesn't it? Especially when it's a woman. And I do think there's a long history of women working alongside men and becoming the muse. If you look at Camille Claudel and Rodin, Camille Claudel was a brilliant sculptor, but she's so-called Rodin's muse, Dora Maar and Picasso. Even Lee Miller and Man Ray, you know, she's often called Man Ray's muse, but Lee was extraordinary, probably more so than Man Ray.
And Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera the same.
Exactly. Yeah, and I don't know why that happens, and I wish that when a woman worked alongside a man, she would be accorded the same kind of respect as the man is always accorded by history. And I think what happens is that there was a book published back in the 80s that was the first to have this anecdote, and then the people who came after that were writing about Christian Dior did all the research on Dior, but when it came to the secondary people in his life, they just copied this anecdote until it became fact. And that happened so quickly and so easily that within the space of 10 years, Mitzah went from first assistant designer to muse in every single anecdote. And then since then, that same paragraph has been copied and recopied and recopied, even by people who should know better, actually, I would say, people who I would have thought more of. So, yeah, it's an injustice that enraged me somewhat, I must say, and I felt like I had to set the record straight.
That's really fascinating. And for me, those days of fashion, and it's changing, probably not as fast as a fashionista like you would like, is that men design and women wear the clothes.
And that's how people, you know, people think fashion is such a female industry. But if you look at the statistics, that is just not brought to bear. If you take, for example, all the clothing companies in the Fortune 500 list, only 5% of those are run by women. 95% of them are run by men. So it's this strange industry where all of the kind of marketing is done to women, all of the magazines are kind of targeted at women, and the women who work behind the scenes are women, but the people who run the companies are the men deciding what women should wear. And every time a female designer kind of pops up, she's somehow squashed down by history and the men.
You mentioned in the book Anne Klein as one who was around in the 70s, who women... maybe you could talk a little bit about Anne Klein.
Yeah. So Anne was remarkable. So as you see from the prologue, the book kind of centres around this fashion battle at Versailles where five French couturiers were invited to compete against five American fashion designers for this title of fashion capital of the world. And so on the French side, you had Marc Bowen from Christian Dior, you had Yves Saint Laurent, you had Pierre Cardin, you had Emmanuel Ungaro, and you had Givenchy, five men. On the American side, you had Stephen Burrows, you had Halston, you had Bill Blass, and you had Oscar de la Renta. So out of the 10 places so far, I've got nine men. The next person they invited was another man, what do you know, called James Galanos. Now, he declined to because he had this thriving business in California and he didn't see the need to compete at the Battle of Versailles. So then they asked another person. Did they ask a woman yet? No, another man. They asked Geoffrey Bean. Now, Geoffrey Bean, I don't know if it was because he was a man or he just had a high ego, but he was outraged that he hadn't been asked first, so he said no because he had his nose put out of joint. And so finally, as the third reserve, they asked a woman. And so Eleanor Lambert was the public relations kind of force behind this fashion battle, and she'd always wanted a woman on the team, being a woman herself. And when she proposed the name Anne Klein to the French, they all said no. They were absolutely not going to have Anne Klein sullying the halls of the Palace of Versailles with her designs because she didn't design couture, and of course that's what the French considered fashion to be. So what Anne Klein did was she revolutionised the way women dress. Before Anne Klein, if you're a woman who worked in an office, the only thing you could wear to that office was a skirt and a jacket that matched in the same colour and the same fabrication, or a shift dress and a jacket that matched again in the same colour and the same fabrication. If you had a very, very contemporary office, maybe a pair of trousers and a jacket, but most offices didn't let women wear trousers back then. And then Anne Klein came along and she went, you know, hang on, I think women want something a little bit more comfortable and with a little bit more ease and a little bit more freedom in their wardrobe. So she came up with the idea of separates, a skirt and a jacket and a pair of trousers and a dress in different colours, different fabrics, things that you could mix and match and create lots of different outfits from, which is exactly the way we dress today. So every time we go to the wardrobe, it's pretty much Anne Klein we have to be thankful to for how we dress today. So you would think, being such a huge influence on fashion some 50 years later, she would have been the first person to be invited to show at the Battle of Versailles.
No.
No, exactly. Because she was a woman, she was the third reserve. And the way she was treated by Halston in particular at Versailles is absolutely shocking. I'll let you discover some of that in the book, but it's all true. One of the things that they did to her was it was absolutely freezing backstage. This battle was held in November and there was no money to renovate Versailles. That's why they were having this fashion battle as a fundraiser. And so they couldn't afford to heat the backstage area either. And so everyone was in their coats and scarves and gloves and freezing backstage trying to sew their dresses last minute. Do you think Anne Klein got a spot backstage with all the men? No, they put her down in the basement, which, as Robin Gavan said in her non-fiction account of the event, was like being tossed out of the fridge and exiled to the freezer. It was even colder down in the basement than it was backstage. So it was quite shocking, actually.
So there's a lot of big male ego energy there.
So much. One of the funniest things, which really kind of, I guess, encapsulates the male egos back there, was Halston, who would refer to himself in the third person. So he had a big tantrum and stormed out at one point.
Well, let me just add, he's dead now, so we can say anything.
And as someone once very famously said, if you did not want people to say mean things about you, you should have behaved better in life, and Halston definitely should have. So he storms out shouting at the top of his voice, Halston is leaving, because that was how he referred to himself. You know, he wasn't I, he was Halston, even to himself, because he thought he was so amazing that he couldn't be called anything other than his first name. So, yeah, so that was Halston for you.
Okay, so we have the Battle of... We know Mitzer. We have the Battle of Versailles and Hawk Jones. Astrid fits into this era in the 70s. Tell us about Astrid.
So Astrid is pretty much coming to Manhattan in 1970, wanting to be something different to her mother, Mitzer Brocard. She wants to be a fashion designer, but what she finds in 1970s New York, on the one hand, is freeing and exciting and wonderful. This is the era of the Women's March for Equality, which happened in 1970, where the only thing that has ever stopped Manhattan before in its tracks is gridlocks of traffic. But on this day, tens of thousands of women marching through the streets literally brought Manhattan to a standstill, protesting for the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment and for equal rights, basically, which that Equal Rights Amendment, interestingly, did not get passed until 2022, so 50 years after the march. So there are all these events that Astrid finds exciting. The youth quake is happening. It feels like culture, art, society, protest movements, fashion are all kind of coming together to create this very exciting way of life. And whilst Astrid kind of thrives in that, she comes up against a man called John Fairchild, who is another real man with a slight ego problem.
Is he dead?
He's also very dead. I don't know that anyone will miss him.
I don't mean
him.
It's good that he's dead, but we can't defame him was my point. No,
and, well, nothing I say here is going to be defamatory because it's all very true. So he was the editor of Women's Wear Daily, which was the seminal fashion trade publication at the time and still is the seminal fashion trade publication. But in the 1970s, it also had a consumer magazine offshoot. So as well as being influential amongst the fashion trade, it was also very influential amongst everyday people. It was read like Vogue was read. And John Fairchild had a problem with a number of people. Unfortunately, most of those people were female. He had this in and out list that he would publish in each edition of his magazine. And it was very common to find female designers on the outside of that list. One woman named Pauline Trigère, who was a brilliant designer, he banned her from ever being mentioned in the pages of his magazine. So as a designer, if you're being banned from the biggest trade, fashion trade publication, how are you going to make your way in the world of fashion? You can't. John Fairchild also said that women should never wear trousers and that women should never be photographed. He believed that, for example, his wife was such a treasure that only he deserved to enjoy the treasure, and photographing her would be too much because that would mean sharing her with others. So if you're a female fashion designer who is putting women in trousers that you're designing and then having those women photographed in those trousers, you can imagine how John Fairchild treated you. He did not like you very much. And this is the environment that I kind of put Astrid into in order to explore how it is that one man can wield so much power and so much influence, and because of that, an entire generation of female fashion designers can be wiped out.
I didn't realise he was so influential. That's horrifying, actually, isn't it?
Yes.
And, you know, this happened all before social media too.
Yeah, it did. And you can only imagine if John Fairchild had a Twitter account. God help us all. He and Elon Musk would have got along really well, I reckon, actually.
So you put Astrid in this really difficult world, and then there's a third character, Blythe Brocard. Tell us about her.
So I've just kind of background Blythe a bit by saying, so Blythe is, her story really goes for 3 weeks in 2010, and Blythe is off to stay in this French chateau for these 3 weeks. And the reason I put her in this French chateau for these 3 weeks is because at the end of 2018, my father-in-law loves a grand gesture, and whenever he has a big birthday, one with a zero or a five at the end of it, he likes to take his whole family away somewhere to celebrate for a week. And there are 29 people in that family, so it's no small feat to do this. And when he turned 80, he suggested that we all go and stay in a French chateau for a week. So obviously my hand was one of the first to go up. Yes, please. So in December 2018, we found ourselves driving up Chateau in the Loire Valley. Now, it's December. It was minus 5 degrees outside. It was really cold. We all had on, obviously, coats and scarves and hats and gloves and everything you could think of, because we're from Australia and minus 5 doesn't work so well for us. And we opened the door of the Chateau. The host opened the door and we walked in expecting the blast of warmth to hit us. And all that hit us was air even colder than the air outside. We think that the hosts were sitting in the window watching for the coach to pull into the driveway, and only then did they go and turn the central heating on. And if you know anything about French chateaux, they're big, cold, drafty places, and it takes at least a week to warm one of those things with the central heating. So it was only on the last day that we were able to kind of take our coats off.
Did you take your UGG boots, being Australians?
Well, funnily enough, the woman who owned the chateau, talk about UGG boots, she had on these boots. Like, I've never seen this kind of thing before. They were like fur covered boots. They're all shaggy and furry, and she had this coat that matched. We nicknamed her the Yeti because that's what she looked like. You will find the Yeti in this book, because the whole experience was so funny that I just thought, oh, I have to write about this. I have to use this in a story. But being a writer, we're very mean people and we don't like our characters to have anything fun going on for them. So I thought, what could be worse than staying in a freezing cold chateau for a week with your family? I thought, okay, staying in a freezing cold chateau for 3 weeks with your ex-husband and your entire ex-family-in-law. So that's the situation Blythe finds herself in at the start of the book. Somewhat challenging.
So these three are all linked, and the story, the book interweaves between these three stories, and we get this building of tension for all three of them. But I do want to go back to that idea of Astrid and the way she's treated by men in the media. And it's a point you make in your author's note at the end, and this isn't spoilers, but you say, you talk about the way the media spits up and chews out women in particular. And you say, I don't think anyone has to look too far to think of a woman who's been remoulded by the media, by gossip and by spite, into something less than she actually was. It's been happening for centuries and it happens still. I hope historical novelists in 100 years' time aren't still writing notes like this. And so Astrid feels it in the traditional media way. Blythe feels it in a different way, being more modern. And I wonder why that was important to you, to show that kind of absolute ill-treatment of women who stick their heads above the parapet.
I guess the thing that most inspired it was something that happened with Taylor Swift. And then after that, it just made me start to see more broadly how many of these kinds of headlines existed out there. So I don't know if anyone's ever seen the Taylor Swift documentary Miss Americana. So it was really that crystallised it for me. So, you know, what happens in the documentary kind of goes back to when she was 20 years old and she's standing on a stage about to receive her very first ever music video award. And Kanye West storms onto the stage, takes the microphone off her before she can begin her acceptance speech. And he says, Beyoncé made the best music video this year. Now, okay, maybe Beyoncé did, but the award was given to Taylor and she's about to accept that award and make her speech. And here's this man walking across the stage, taking the microphone out of her hand and basically saying, you don't deserve to win. That would have been a crushing experience. Anyway, she handled it pretty well. And at that time, the media were on her side. Everyone just agreed that Kanye had been out of line. Fast forward a few years and Kanye puts out his song Famous, in which he declares in the chorus that he made that bitch, as he calls Taylor Swift, famous. Because of course Taylor Swift could not possibly be capable of making herself famous as the biggest selling female artist of all time. And then a number of things happened around the release of that song, to the point where the media turned on Taylor Swift 360 degree. They decided she was playing the victim. She was, you know, protesting too much. She deserved to be treated like that. And it ended up with a hashtag trending on Twitter. It was the Taylor Swift is over party hashtag. And it became the number one trending hashtag on Twitter. And in Miss Americana, Taylor Swift says, do you know how many people have to hate you for that to be the number one trending hashtag on Twitter? And I thought, wow, that is so true. There are literally millions of people all around the world who've never met Taylor Swift, who don't know anything about her, but who have decided, based on headlines in the media, that they hate her. And how can they do that to somebody? And it made me look at all these other headlines. You know, there was one about Meghan Markle, and the headline was how Meghan Markle's flowers almost poisoned Princess Charlotte. Because, you know, like Meghan's got a gun hiding in her bouquet of flowers, I don't know. And Amy Winehouse, the newest member of the Stupid Club, that headline was published the day after she died of an overdose. Shocking. And I thought, in all of these headlines about all of these women, there is no indication of what they do. There is no indication that they are successful women within their careers, that they're at the top of their game, that they are, like Taylor, the biggest selling female artist of all time, that they're inspiring women, that we should be looking up to them and celebrating them. Instead, what we have is that they are stupid, they're poisoning young princesses, they're falling pregnant, don't know who the dad is.
Crazy,
you know, being made famous by Kanye West because they can't do it themselves. And again, a bit of rage went into that. And I thought, this is something I need to pull apart in the book. And so I kind of used both Astrid and Blythe to do that as a result of what kind of happened to Mitza, to show how it's been happening for such a long time and it's happening still. And like I say in my author's note, hoping that in 100 years' time it stops, but don't know.
One of the most awful stories I heard, and there was a sort of a trend, and, you know, Lindsay Lohan was one. She was in the tabloids all the time for basically being mentally ill. Charlotte Church, does anyone remember or know Charlotte Church? The singer, the English, young English singer. She's an opera singer, beautiful voice. As she was heading to 18, one of the tabloids did a countdown to legal for Charlotte Church. It's just shocking, isn't it?
It is. Do you know what? In the airport lounge this morning on my way here, they were doing a, I don't know who it was because the TV was up above my head and behind me, but I could hear the voiceover and I was just sitting there shaking my head. They were talking about the Britney Spears memoir that's apparently just come out, and they were saying, oh, you know, Britney's refused to do any television interviews. She must be so mentally unstable to not be able to do a television interview. I'm thinking, if I was Britney, I wouldn't do a bloody television interview either, because what are you going to say about her? Here you are, based on her not doing interviews, calling her mentally unstable. Imagine what you're going to call her if she does do a television interview. So it was like, okay, nothing is changing.
And I mean, I think the way they were treated maybe helped contribute to the mental illness as well. So it's the media saying, oh, they're all crazy. We, not that we made them crazy. No, no, I think they did. There's a whole lot of fun. Before we go to questions, and we will in a sec, there's a whole lot of fun in the Astrid sections, I think, about the 70s in New York, and there's Mick Jagger makes an appearance, and there's the great discos and the clothes, and I wondered if you had fun writing that.
Oh, it was so much fun. I feel like 1970s fashion is wildly misunderstood. Everyone kind of thinks ABBA, but 1970 to 73, it's really influenced by those beautiful, slinky evening dresses of the 1930s, and that's very much what it was like. And it's quite stunning, and so it was great in, firstly, to be able to kind of show people, hopefully, that there's a lot more to 1970s fashion than ABBA, and then to pull in all of these other amazing people that were around at the time. So, you know, one of the seminal fashion moments of those early 1970s is Bianca Jagger's wedding tuxedo. So, of course, that had to go into the book. I have stolen it from Yves Saint Laurent and given it to someone else, but I don't think Yves Saint Laurent will mind. As well as the... this is the very early days of disco. It's only just started to be used as an adjective. In fact, my copy editor and I had a whole back and forth battle about when the word disco was first used, which I think I won. So it was fun to explore some of those very early discos, the Cheetah and the Electric Circus in Manhattan, which again you'll find in the book, and all the people who were around back then. You know, Houston was pretty big, Liza Minnelli, Dana Vreeland, that infamous Vogue editor. So lots of cameos from lots of people who you might recognise in the pages of the book. And it was very enjoyable to kind of, in those sections, be not writing about the war and be writing about something that was actually really fun and listening to the music at the same time. We have a playlist, actually, to go with the book, and there's a QR code right in the back, so you can scan that and upload the playlist and listen while you read.
I'll have to do that because I was around in the 70s, but I was very young. But I remember, I was just saying this before we came on to Natasha, that I remember Brown... big collars, very big hair. So I'm thinking that was a slightly more glamorous, early 70s.
Yes, definitely much more glamorous than late 70s, yeah.
We're going to go to questions. Do we have a spare mic? Okay. Hands up. It's always hard being the first.
Oh, it is. The first one is always the hardest to extract.
Right in the second row. Thank you.
Hi, Natasha. I was just wondering, when you finish your research, how do you write? Do you sort of... Are you an author that can write from, like, chapter one, page one, and go all the way through? Or do you hop about with particular characters and what they're doing at different times?
So with my books, up until... So this one's got the three different timelines. Usually my books have two timelines, a contemporary timeline and a historical timeline. And when I'm writing one like that, I always write the historical timeline in its entirety first, because that's the usually the longest timeline, and that's really where the story is grounded. And then I'll write the whole contemporary storyline, and then I'll cut them up and splice them together. So in those books, you normally have sort of six or so chapters of historical, then a few of contemporary, then another six or so of historical, and it kind of interweaves like that. With this one, with the three timelines, it's the first time I've ever not started with the historical, because I was still doing this research around Mitzah, and I was still very aware that with a couple of these things that I'd found, that there must be so much more to find, and I didn't want to start writing the wrong version of Mitzah. I wanted to really get her right in my head before I committed her to paper and made her into something again that she was not. And then the 70s, it was the first time I'd written a story set in that period, so I didn't feel confident to start there either. So actually, the first storyline I wrote in this book was the contemporary storyline, because I really felt like I knew that I'd been in that chateau that Blythe ends up in, and I knew how to kind of unravel that part of the story. So it was really interesting to me that I started in that storyline, whereas, you know, I'm a historical novelist, but here I am writing contemporary times. And then I went back to Astrid's story there, and then I went back to Mitzah's from there. And I tried a number of different ways to weave those together after the storylines were written. I tried the way I normally do, by having a sort of a six-chapter chunk of one storyline, and it just didn't work for me. Tried a few other variations, and then I ended up settling on the way this is structured, where we alternate between Astrid's storyline and Blythe's storyline, and then the end of each part is bookended with a chunk of Mitzah. So we come into the story feeling with the same impression of Mitzah that I had prior to doing my research, and then we start to unravel that slowly as the book progresses.
How long does it take you to write a book? And once you get your idea, do you just lock yourself away in a room and then write and resurface? And then one other little question, your dress is beautiful.
Thank you.
Where did you get it from?
So it takes about 2.5 years for each book, and not all of that is writing, so some of that is just thinking time. I'm an inveterate pantser when it comes to writing, as in I fly by the seat of my pants. I'm not able to plan a book up front, so it really unfolds for me page by page as I'm writing, the way it does for a reader. And so what that means is I need a little bit of thinking time up front to have enough to begin with. And I always have like one strong idea, but it's not enough for a whole book, and I need to wait until the other two ideas come and attach itself to the first one, like a bit like magnets. I always need three things that somehow in my head say to me, this needs to go together to become a book. So there's that bit of thinking time. Then the writing begins. I'm a quick first drafter. The biggest work for me is in the rewriting. I rewrite and I rewrite and I rewrite. I do about 5 or 6 drafts, and then it goes to the publisher, and then there's a whole editing process. And so that whole process takes about 2.5 years per book. So we're always working a couple of books ahead. So I'm talking about, I actually have to go and have a flick through this book before I sit down and talk about it on tour, because I'm in another world entirely. Was there another question? Sorry, did I forget one? Oh, my dress. So it's an Australian brand called Saloni. It's actually quite a few years old now, but it's one that I love because it's kind of got a vintagey feel. Thank you.
Hello, Natasha. I've just found out about you from your mother. Your mother and I are actually first cousins.
Oh, yes. She mentioned that, yes, you were coming. Oh, my mum's a good marketer. Yeah.
So she suggested I should come here. No, it was actually her sister. And I'm just wondering, do you always write about fashion in your books? Because I didn't know anything about you until your mother told me, and that was only last month. And I live
your marketing manager, your mother?
Yes. And I actually live in Clare, and I had to go to the library to see if they had any of your books, and I found three of them, and I've borrowed one. And that was The Three Lives of Alex Sinclair, is it? And I'm about third way through. And it's all about fashion. And is that what you always write about?
I don't always write about fashion. Most of my books have a slight fashion theme to them, but so I've written about one of the first female obstetricians in New York City in the 1920s. I've written about one of the only female photojournalists who reported on the Second World War from the front lines in Europe. I've written about Christian Dior's resistance heroine sister Catherine Dior. So I cover a lot of different things. I've covered the amazing female pilots who worked for the Air Transport Auxiliary in the Second World War and who flew in incredibly dangerous situations. But often there is a slight fashion theme woven in there as well, because I like the way that those things can show both the dark and the light of what happened with women at that time. And also, I think fashion is such a key part of who we are. We all wear clothes and we all make choices about the clothes that we put on, and sometimes we use those clothes as armour, sometimes we use them as camouflage, sometimes we use them just to make ourselves feel better, sometimes we don't think too much about it. And I love the way that something so ordinary has such an extensive history and can be so interesting to unravel when you look at the stories that might be hidden in decades-old couture gowns. So a lot of that gets woven into stories of amazing women from history who did all kinds of incredible things and who've been overlooked and forgotten, like Lee Miller, like those female pilots, like Catherine Dior.
Hi, I was just wondering what kind of books you enjoy reading, what kind of authors, genres?
So I do read a lot of historical fiction. It's my kind of first love, but I read pretty widely. One of the best books I've read so far this year is a book called Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver. If you haven't read that, go immediately out to the bookshop and read it, because it's probably not only the best book I've read this year, but one of the best books I've ever read in my whole life. Another amazing book I've just read by a debut Australian author is called At the Foot of the Cherry Tree, and it's about the first Japanese war brides who came to Australia at the end of the Second World War. It's a piece of Australian history I'm ashamed to say I knew nothing whatsoever about. And Ali writes it just so...
Ali Parker.
Ali Parker, yep. She writes it extraordinarily. So that's another one I would absolutely recommend you go out and pick up. Again, that's historical fiction. And one that I'm really looking forward to reading is one that so many people have recommended to me to read after they've read this, is Wifedom by Anna Funder, which apparently deals with some very similar things to this book in terms of George Orwell's wife and how she has been overlooked and forgotten by the historical record. So, yeah, pretty wide kind of reading, but I love all those kinds of things.
I think we have time for one more question. Lady in the front row, lucky last.
When I first came across your name and the fact you wrote historical fiction, I thought, what an amazingly good name for a writer of historical fiction, Natasha Lester. I just thought it was very appropriate and immediately thought, is it a pen name or is it your family name?
Oh, that's very lovely. No, it is my actual name. And I'd never thought about it being particularly good as a writer. So I'll have to thank my mother, not just for doing her marketing, but for giving me the name Natasha. Lester is my married name. It's not my maiden name. But yes, thank you.
Right. And your father-in-law is a Lester?
He is a Lester, yes. He's the man with the grand gestures and the French chateaus. In fact, we're going to South Africa in December with him because he's turning 85. And he felt that 85, Europe was a little too far for him this time, so we'd go to South Africa instead. So we're going on safari, which I'm very much looking forward to. So who knows, there might be an African safari disaster happening in the next book. Stay tuned.
Out of Africa, yes. In a frock.
Safari glamour.
Are you from Perth?
I am from Perth, yes. I've lived in Perth for most of my life, although I have lived in Melbourne and London for a few years in between.
So I guess we are related if you're a Lester from Perth, just as you're related to that lady out there.
Oh.
Only by marriage.
Right. Oh, lots of relations in the room tonight. How lovely.
It's Adelaide, one degree of separation, you know.
I reckon you guys just want to come to South Africa, don't you?
The tour bus is full, we're sorry. Thank you very much, everyone, for coming. Thank you, Marion Libraries and the staff here, Jess and Salma and everyone, and Sound Guy up the back. Everyone wave to him. Thank you. Thank you to everyone. Thanks for coming. And thank you to Natasha Lester.
Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you.